Hey, everyone, we've got a special treat at the end of the podcast. We have a new theme song.
Well, George Conway, he's a man with a plan. Got to sit down with Sarah Long. We'll take a stand.
We're testing out for the pod, so give it a listen and let us know what you think.
So the judge in this case just issued an expanded gag order, barring Trump from talking publicly about his own family.
He behaves in many, many respects like a mob boss. He lacks sufficient self-control to be able to comply with these orders, I think. And the question is, what do you do when he ultimately crosses the line, which actually he probably has
already. What do they do?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to George Conway Explains It All. I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and because I am not a lawyer, I've asked my good friend George Conway from the Society for the Rule of Law to explain the legal news to me, roughly every week. Before we get started, I wanted to let folks know that we're hosting a live taping. Did you know this? Of our podcast in Washington, D.C.?
This.
Yeah.
This
put it on your calendar.
Disclosed.
Put it on your calendar. Washington, D.C. on May 15th at 6th and I.
Where?
At 6th and I.
Where?
That's a place. It's a location.
Oh.
It's both
who's
an address.
First?
It's both an address and a physical location.
Second? I don't know who's on third.
If you live in D.C., you know 6th and I. Tickets are still available, so come see us.
Oh, I did know that.
Yeah, you know that.
Yeah.
We're going to do this. We're going to do it for all the people.
Okay. 6 to 9, yes.
JBL and Tim.
I thought you were saying, I thought she said 6 to 9. I'm just spaced out today, but.
We'll do, it's going to be good. It's going to be a double feature of me where we do Sarah and George and then we do TNL.
We don't fill that place. It's kind of big.
No, it's really big. It's actually intimidating. Honestly, if you've already come to see us, just you should pity come see us one more time.
We'll pay you to come.
we
don't want to be like a Trump rally.
Yeah, that's right. We need to fill the place up.
Yeah.
So actually, before we start with the legal news, we've got two housekeeping items.
Okay.
The first is that you've decided that we have merch.
We have merch. Yes.
You want to show people the merch?
Well, this is the merch. I mean, this was the draft merch.
It's been an iterative process.
And then this is the final merch with bigger lettering so that even, you know, a psycho could read it.
Yeah.
And it says, vote for Joe, not the psycho. And here is a draft bumper sticker that I personally made. And I'm going to try to prevail on you.
Graphic design is your passion.
It's not hard. It's just basically you pick the colors and the font. The font is key. It's got to be a serif font.
Yeah.
And, you know, this one is a little fancier because it's got the J down there. But it's fine. It works. It's, you know, I like
this.
I think this is the slogan that's going. This is going to be like Tippy Canoe and Tyler, too.
Yeah.
People
that's
are going to, 200 years from now, people are going to say, wow, whoever invented that slogan, vote for Joe, not the psycho, he was a real genius.
Yeah.
A stable genius.
And you came up with that because you called me the day you thought you were very excited about this
slogan. I was very excited.
Yeah. And so that's great.
I mean, I would do Eminem proud.
Okay. If you want to get this hat, we're going to put the little link in the show notes or at the bottom of the YouTube.
And
I don't really
don't
know.
Don't be
There's
afraid
people who know how to
wear
that.
It everywhere. Let them get mad at you.
Oh, man. Okay, here's the other thing I want to talk about. This is actually the bigger deal.
Bigger deal? Okay.
You gave almost $1 million to Joe Biden this week. It like made news.
Well,
not personally.
It's not like I'm paying for his legal fees.
That's true. But you gave it to his what? His campaign?
The Biden Victory Fund, which is a combined fundraising entity that consists of the campaign and the national party, the Democratic Party, and a bunch of state parties and so on and so forth. And so you can give, they allocate it in some way.
So you gave
the maximum allowable by law.
Which
yes.
is actually a weird number.
$929,600. It's got something to do with the intersection of federal and state laws. I have no idea. But when you get these things, I mean, I remember every year of presidential campaigns send these out and they have these joint fundraising vehicles for the presidential campaign that combines fundraising for the parties and for the state parties and for the campaign, and they come up with some maximum number that's based upon, you know, the federal limits and the state limits, and that
and
was
you were
the
like, I'm going for the limit. Give me the top.
Yeah, I mean,
talk about why it was important for you to do that. Like,
I mean, I was asked to do the fundraiser, to headline the fundraiser, and I said, sure, yeah, I'll, you know, whatever you guys want, I'll do. I'll carry people on my back. barefoot on broken glass, the polls on November 5th if I have to. And so I said, I'd do the fundraiser. And then I'm looking at the invitation and it was like, whoa, yeah, my name's big words there. And I read the whole thing and I guess, oh, I should give something. And I started thinking about it and I was like, okay, what's the, I can give $5,000, $10,000. Well, maybe I should give 50. I don't know. And I thought about it. It's like, this is the most important thing that I could ever give money to in my life. I hope they spend it wisely. I'm going to trust them to. It's, I mean, this is like, okay, so this comes out of maybe it comes out of my children's inheritance, right? Mm. But what could they, what more of a bequest can we give them than a functioning constitutional republic? And, you know, I thought about that and that's why I decided to do it. And at that point, there was no question I was going to do that. And I, you know, it's more than I ever have given, probably in the aggregate, to political candidates or to, frankly, even charities, I'm sure, in my entire life. But, I mean, this is for all the marbles. It really is. And I don't want to be emotional about it, but it really, everybody needs to, I mean, do what, anybody out there, just do what you can. Okay. It doesn't have to be writing a check to the Biden Victory Fund or doing it. It's just whatever you can, you need, people need to do, whether it's just talking to their neighbors, making a recurring donation for a dollar or two or something. I don't know. Whatever you can do. This is so important. I words can't describe it. And I just, my hope is that I can get a few people to do the same. Or not the same, but get people to give a little more than they otherwise would have, because it's really important.
I do think if you're a Democratic donor and somebody like you who's given, I would say if you've looked back at the history of your giving, it is mostly to Republicans.
I think it's basically 99% of Republicans. Once my former law partner, Bernie Nussbaum, remember him? He was the first White House counsel in the Clinton administration. May he rest in peace. He was a big Dem. He was a friend of Hillary's. He once got me to give $200 to attend some luncheon in his honor, you know, for the state Democratic Committee in New York. That was basically the only time I ever gave money to a Democrat.
Yeah.
To Democrats. But this isn't about, I don't view this as giving money to Democrats. I give this is for the country. This is about the country. It's not, I mean, there's, you know, there's a rational, there is the rational and the irrational. There's the hateful and the constructive, and we're being forced to choose between an abyss that we can't even see the bottom of, because it keeps getting worse and worse and worse, and normality, and that's what this is about.
Yeah, and if you're a Democratic donor,
I'm going to shame them all into giving more than they ever have. If this schmuck ass Republican who voted for Trump in 2016 can write this effing check, guys, come on. All you rich limousine liberals, get to it.
All right. Okay, let's start down in Florida with Jack Smith and his filing in the Mar-a-Lago classified documents case.
That was something.
So we talked about this last episode, but just to remind folks, Judge Cannon asked both parties to submit proposed jury instructions based on two, and I think the technical term is bananas, formulations of the law. And those were both due on April 2nd, so we're taping on April 3rd. No, we're taping on April 4th, so this is a couple days ago. So before we get to the substance of the party's filings this week, can you just remind us what was so odd for Judge Cannon? Like, why it was so odd for her to do this in the first place?
It was prompted by motions to dismiss by Trump, in which they made various bananas arguments. And the principal argument that comes to mind is this argument that was not the product of any brilliant legal mind. It was the product of this fellow from Judicial Watch, who is not a lawyer, who basically—
The guy with the arms?
The guy, yes, the guy with the arms.
I get his direct mail requests.
Yes, you know, he must have dropped a weight on his head or something. But He misread. There was this case in the 1990s involving Bill Clinton, and Clinton met with a historian, Taylor Branch, was it? I think.
Why are you looking at me like I would know? I don't know.
You're like an encyclopedia. But anyway, so he meets with a historian, and they tape, you know, his thoughts about things that are going on, so that this guy can write a book. And he gets a copy of these cassettes, and he takes the cassettes to his private residence upstairs in the White House, and he puts it in his socks drawer. And so later, somebody, the Judicial Watch actually, filed, or some, maybe it wasn't Judicial Watch, somebody filed a request or some made some claim that these materials were presidential records. Mm-hmm. And it was litigated in the United States District Court here in Washington. And the court basically held, no, these were personal. These were personal records under the PRA, the Presidential Records Act. And the Presidential Records Act basically says that presidential records, meaning stuff you use in the course of doing business as president, things that go to the president from staff and things that, you know, where he responds to that, or things that have something to do with his actual working, are presidential records. And so the issue here was, well, okay, he's recounting events to a historian about things that he did in office, but this wasn't for the purpose of his work. It was for the purpose of the historian's work. And, you know, maybe he was going to use that for his own personal diary someday or whatever. And the court basically said, this doesn't fall within the presidential records definition of the Presidential Records Act. Somehow, this fellow from Judicial Watch, Tom Fitton is his name?
Tom Fitton, good pull.
Yeah, I keep thinking of the guy in the 90s who sued his mother. Never mind. You remember him, right?
No.
Forget it. Okay, I'm just dating myself. But anyway, he twists this opinion into saying that the president can basically say whatever he wants is personal. Mm-hmm. If, you know, if he can get a – and to the point where the Trump people are arguing that the president could get a document with the nuclear codes on it and say, oh, this is personal.
Right.
And so,
is this like the declassify with my mind type thing?
But it's even worse, because it's even worse – than the declassify with his mind thing, because at least the declassification, you know, the declassification with his mind, it doesn't change who owns the property. This is like literally saying that he can decide that the property of the United States of America, in the property interests of the United States of America, in a document that, say, reflects our deepest, most important nuclear secrets or intelligence information, that he can just make it personal.
Right.
And that's just insane. Right. More than the point, it's not just insane, it's just completely inconsistent with the definitions that are right up front in the Presidential Records Act. But anyway, so Trump and his lawyers make a motion to dismiss the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Florida before our friend Judge Cannon. And she issues some mealy-mouthed decision saying, this is kind of hard. They say this, and these I say that, and I'll have to see. We'll see what the facts show at trial, which is nonsense, because this is a pure issue of law. It's not. There is no evidence to be weighed on this. The documents fit the definition of presidential records, which they do unquestionably, because they are things that were presented to the president in connection with his official duties. It doesn't even matter whether or not they're classified, frankly. Mm-hmm. It's just, if he gets a memo from a staffer and it relates to some business in the White House, in the government, that is a presidential record, and it belongs to the United States of America. It belongs to you and me.
I'm not classified in
our capacity as citizens. Yeah, okay, right. I don't mean personally, but it is the property of the United States of America. And so the notion that she's even entertaining this is a dangerous thing for a couple of reasons. One, it's wrong. And secondly, if she should be denying this motion to dismiss. If she denies the motion to dismiss, it's fine. If she grants the motion to dismiss now, then, which she didn't, Jack Smith could take it up to the 11th Circuit and get it reversed. But if in the middle of a trial she declares, so let's say the government rests its case and she says, I find that the government, as a matter of law, has not proven these to be presidential records, that judgment can't be appealed because of the double jeopardy prohibition in the Constitution. Once jeopardy attaches, meaning once the jury is sworn in, essentially, if the court directs a verdict in favor of the defendant, the government cannot appeal, even if what the court has done is completely bananas. And so basically, that was one problem here, was that, she's saying this is a factual issue. It's not even a factual issue. It's not even close to a factual issue. It's a pure, simple issue of law, and it's black and white. And only a person who can't read or doesn't or is insane would say otherwise, that somehow the president can just declare a book about, you know, the nuclear codes in the football that the military AK, president can declare that to be those are personal records. Those are my personal nuclear.
Taking them home.
Yeah, I'm taking them home with me. Yeah, to Mar-a-Lago and you know, it's just insane. But the other thing that she did after she denied the motion to dismiss or deferred it to the trial was she asked for proposed jury instructions. Now, it's a little early to do jury instructions. Normally, you do that closer to the trial, which she doesn't seem to be inclined to hold anytime soon. But she asked for instructions that incorporated the ridiculous, absurd, insane construction or non-construction, if you will, of the Presidential Records Act that was advanced by, you know, the Tom Fitton theory as endorsed by Trump. And this is like, you're asking the government to propose jury instructions. You're asking both sides, but the government to propose jury instructions that are completely inconsistent with the government's position on the law and completely inconsistent with the text of the act. And it's just completely insane. So what Jack Smith did is he complied with the request, the order by the court to produce such draft jury instructions. And he basically, in tone, it's a very lawyerly document. It's a very lawyerly submission, but it really kind of it mocks her. I mean, it's like it's a piece of writing. It's a brilliant piece of writing. The tone is respectful, but it just mocks her. And what it does is, it wrote jury instructions, and jury instructions are usually structured this way. They make a few preliminary premises. They say to the jury that, you know, there are classified records and they're this, or there are presidential records and they're defined as that, and does that sort of boilerplate stuff. And then what they did is they wrote the proposed instructions like with correct statements of law at the beginning, and then they said, in spite of this, I instruct you to find, you know, to make this finding that is completely inconsistent with what we just said the law was. And that's the technique they used basically to just try to show her and the world how ridiculous what she was asking for was.
So, and do you think she is so shamed? Is she shamed by this, or did she know what she was doing? Because the whole thing is just a tactic to like get this thing delayed and kicked around.
Well, I have come to the conclusion that she's in so far over her head.
Yeah,
right. I think she's completely incompetent, to tell you the truth. I mean, she writes English sentences that sometimes seem like they make sense, but she's just utterly, completely incompetent. This woman should not be a federal judge. And you can see that just in the way she's conducted these proceedings and in the fact that she's actually falling behind. She can't keep up with the work. And there are just so many things that are just piling up. And I think, you know, I mean, part of it may be that she does have some motivation or some skepticism about the prosecution or motivation to help Trump. Maybe it's personal ambition or otherwise. But she's not very good at it.
Yeah.
Okay. If you were going to help Trump, you'd just not do any. You wouldn't do some of this shit, so to speak. You wouldn't be doing these absurd things. You would just slow it down. That's how you do things. And so I think it's a combination of maybe she has a bad motive, or maybe she has a bias. I don't like to say that judges are corrupt. I will say when they are completely stupid that they are stupid.
Yeah.
And this judge is, I mean, I wouldn't do it if I were practicing, but this is just stupidity on her part. She does not know what she's doing. She doesn't even know how to help the guy. That said, she can do a lot of damage. And one of the things that is important about this submission that Jack Smith made the other day is it basically said, they said to Judge Cannon, look, Judge, if you're going to do this, And we disagree with you when we think it's ridiculous. I mean, didn't quite use that language, but pretty much that's what they're saying. You better tell us now, sooner rather than later, because we're going to take you up to the Court of Appeals. Because we can't have this happening close to trial or during the trial. And so basically, they threw down the gauntlet. And they're basically saying, you know, we're ready to take you up. And I have to say, I mean, it's a very difficult thing to throw a judge off a case for being biased. It's almost impossible. But sometimes you can get a court of appeals. I've seen it happen in the Second Circuit, where a judge makes so many mistakes in one direction and is so screwed something up that the Court of Appeals just says, we reverse and we remand and we direct the chief judge of the district court to assign this case to another judge.
Yeah.
And it's very, very insulting to the lower court judge. So they don't like to do that to their colleagues. But in the 11th Circuit, I'm told by mavens of 11th Circuit practice, 11th Circuit is the circuit of the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals that covers the states, the great states of Florida, Georgia, and Alabama. The 11th Circuit, there's sort of like an unwritten three strikes rule, as I understand it, that if the district court judge does something that's completely wild three times in sort of the wrong direction, they will strongly consider taking somebody off the case. And basically, she's done that already.
Yeah.
So this could be, if she persists, this could be strike three. And at this point, you know, one of the things that you have to consider when you are a lawyer and you've got a judge who you think is just stacking the deck against you, and I mean legitimately think that, not like the way that Trump thinks that everybody's stacking the deck against him, even though, you know, he brings it all on himself by being a criminal. You hesitate to make the motion because it's like if you lose, it's like the old adage, if you shoot at the king, you better not miss. Mm-hmm. And you better not miss when you're trying to take out a district judge. Unless, of course, you're just trying to create a record for an appeal. But here there wouldn't be an appeal if she does what the worst scenario would be to direct a verdict during the trial, which would be unappealable. But anyway, so it's a very tricky thing when you are a litigant, whether civil or criminal, whether you be the United States of America or an ordinary litigant, whether it be a civil litigant or a criminal defendant, it's a very tricky calculus because you need to succeed. Here, the other piece of the calculus is that delay. Mm-hmm. Anything that, well, if you try to take her off the case or you try to take one of these pretrial rulings up to the Court of Appeals. And there's not normally an appeal route for some of this stuff. The route is it's not technically appealable under the ordinary appellate statutes, but there is something called mandamus, a writ of mandamus, which essentially says this judge is not doing her job. Mm. Okay, she's off the wall. So Court of Appeals, you need to order this judge to do her job. And that's what, you know, and that's a very, very tough high standard. But if they did that here, I mean, I think they're pretty, I think they could get it. And I think one of the considerations would be delay, because it would take a while, it would take a few weeks, but they're not going to get this case tried this year anyway, I suspect at this point.
Yeah.
And so at some point, if she, I think the next time she twitches the wrong way and does something that they can take up, like if she, I don't know, I mean, the next time she does something, there's a pretty good chance, I think, that Jack Smith will seek a writ of mandamus and then try to get her kicked off the case. And that will be, you know, that'll be the most important piece of litigation in the case.
But if Donald Trump wins the election, will any of that even matter?
No. If Donald Trump wins the election, these cases all go away.
Yeah, right. Hey, just, we went deep there on Jack Smith.
As do we. We will go away. We will be writing you from New Zealand or Guantanamo or, you know, Antarctica? Yeah, Antarctica would maybe be safe. He wouldn't find us there.
We will podcast from wherever we go.
Yes.
Hopefully we're in a cell together.
We will need a big satellite dish, yeah.
What did Trump's filing have anything interesting? Like, he had to do the same thing Jack Smith did, right?
I didn't read it, and I didn't hear anything about it.
It's like, fine, whatever.
You know, I mean, it was the same old BS.
Okay. So, moral of the story, there's still a long way to go.
Long way to go. That is not, that case is, yes, that case, I have given up hope that this case is going to get tried anytime soon. It's a 2025 case. It is still, this is the best case against Trump, just on the merits. It's just, they have him dead to rights. Yeah. They have him dead to rights. And these are, there are multiple counts under the Espionage Act, and each of these, there's 10-year maximum on each of these counts of under the Espionage Act. And then there's obstruction. There's no question. He's the closest thing to guilty as a matter of law than you could get. there's no such concept, but that
she's done her job for him then, right? Because it's
But not in a competent way. But yeah,
right.
Yeah,
yeah.
She's bumbled her way, and I think she's, you know, I mean, I think this is a very interesting character study of her. I think she's a very stubborn, resentful person who's going to be difficult to deal with for them. I mean, yeah. I just think she doesn't know what she's doing, and then she's got a chip on her shoulder, and she's probably angry at all the criticism that is being thrust in her direction by people like us. You know that type of person. I mean, you see these judges from time to time. They're the worst judges. The judges who have a chip on their shoulder and who are angry and have a bias. And I think that's what we have here. And it's not good.
Yeah.
He got very lucky getting this judge.
Drawing her.
Yeah.
Hey guys, a little breaking news to insert into the pod here. After we finished recording, Judge Eileen Cannon did deny Trump's motion to dismiss. So that is good news based on the discussion we were having. And I hope you're enjoying the pod. Stick with it. Okay, we got to pay some bills. And because you have given all your money away, we got to get some more here. So George is going to do his first ad.
My first ad. I'm going to do my best. I'm inspired by listening to baseball on the radio as a kid. I grew my radio voice. And Sarah, this is my first ad read. Are you excited?
I am excited.
Okay,
I'm excited.
All right, today's episode is sponsored by The Perfect Gene. And Sarah, the best thing about this ad is that we're allowed to swear. And so please swear whenever you like. I don't know who wrote that.
I'm not the one who swears on this show.
I don't
know
that. I'm the one who swears. Yeah, what am I talking about? As for our sponsor, The Perfect Gene makes great-looking, perfect-fitting jeans that are as comfortable as sweatpants. And this is actually a true thing.
Yeah, you're wearing them
wearing
right
them.
Now,
they
right?
They sent me a pair, and I'm wearing them, and these are actually, no shit. These are these are the most comfortable pair of jeans I've ever had. And I was sent a pair, and I safely say they fit me perfectly and are incredibly comfortable. Okay, I said that already. Here's their secret. They use a special denim fabric that's soft and has the perfect amount of stretch so that you can squat, do yoga, or sit around reading legal news and tweeting. I don't do yoga. Tweeting doesn't really require me to kick my leg up like that, you know. But
look at what I was able to do. Look what you can do in these jeans.
Yeah, my hamstrings not so much, but my jeans are okay. They make 6 different fits and have waist sizes from 26 to 50. I no longer have those. And lengths from 26 to 38. So they've got you covered. We should send some pairs to Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah.
Okay. And for a limited time, our listeners get 15% off their first order, plus free shipping at theperfectgene.nyc. You can just Google The Perfect Gene and use code ASKGEORGE15 for 15% off. And Sarah, it can be a real struggle to find a pair of jeans that fit just right. Mm. I always dread when I have to get new ones, but now I don't have to worry about that because I have the perfect jean. They also have t-shirts. I want to check those out. So it's finally time to ditch uncomfortable jeans by going to theperfectgene.nyc. That's theperfectgene.nyc. Our listeners get 15% off your first order, plus free shipping, free returns, and free exchanges when you use the code ASKGEORGE15 at checkout. That's 15% off for new customers at theperfectgene.nyc with promo code ASKGEORGE15. And after you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about The Perfect Gene, and please support our show and tell them we sent you.
All right. Now, let's talk about Hush Money.
Hush.
Let's move on.
I want to talk about porn stars.
To the election interference case in New York, Trump has asked yet again for this case to be postponed.
Porn star hush money case. Let's just get real here.
Why do you liked the election interference framing?
It's fine. It is election interference, but
But you like saying porn star?
Yes.
Okay. That's fair enough.
I mean, Donald Trump paid off hush money, paid hush money to a porn star, and she didn't stay hushed. I think that's, I just love saying that.
Yeah.
I mean, think about that. Is that the art of the deal? Not a good deal.
It was not a good deal.
$130,000. Plus, he had to gross up the taxes for Michael Cohen.
I'm surprised. And then he got indicted for it. So,
am I getting in trouble?
Trump, once again, he wants this case to be postponed. He's asking again. So this time, he claims there's too much.
For somebody who's so innocent, he doesn't want to go to trial. Why is that?
Well, he keeps saying there's too much pretrial publicity, and it's prejudicing them against them, which is funny. Because, and Bragg's office made this case that they opposed Trump's motion, obviously.
Where's the publicity coming from?
I want to read part of Bragg's filing. Defendant's own incessant rhetoric is generating significant publicity, and it would be perverse to reward defendant with an adjournment based on media attention he is actively seeking. This just feels like classic Trump, right? Acting
Absolutely.
Like the victim in circumstances right. entirely of his own making.
Right.
Yeah.
It's the classic... Darvo, where you deny, and then Darvo is this psychological term where you deny, attack, reverse victim and offender, and that's basically what he does all the time. And here he's basically saying, you know, I'm not doing anything wrong, and when he is, mm-hmm. and then accusing the other side of doing it, and then claiming to be the victim.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, that's essentially what he does. That's the classic narcissist approach to everything.
He's not going to get this one, right?
No, this judge is not going to give him. It's ridiculous. And the other good point that the prosecution makes is this publicity isn't going to go away. This case is going to have a certain amount of publicity no matter what happens. And you combine that with the argument that he's causing most of the publicity. There's just no argument here. And the fact of the matter is it just means that the jury selection has to be done in a certain way. You have to interview the jurors. You have to ask them questions. And they're going to do the best they can. And that, you know, most cases do not get postponed or moved or anything like that for no matter how much publicity there was. And sometimes I remember there was one case when I clerked. No, not before when I clerked. When I was in law school, they had this big, big New York City scandal involving the Parking Violations Bureau. And basically every major politician other than Ed Koch got in trouble. And the defense moved for a change of venue because of the extensive publicity. I mean, it was literally in the papers every day, every time somebody would go into the grand jury. And so the judge said, okay, fine. I'm going to go to Connecticut and we'll try the case in Connecticut. And so they basically had a bunch of Connecticut homemakers and, you know, just people who were completely shocked. Don't read the New York Post every day and guilty all along. Sometimes he gets your one. But here, he's not asking for change of venue. He's asking to put this off. He doesn't want to be tried in any court, anytime, anywhere, because he knows he's guilty.
Yeah, but he won't get this one. So he's talking about it so much, though. This is like...
Well, it's not just that he's talking about it. He's basically just, he's using the opportunity to attack the judge's daughter.
Well, this is it. So the judge in this case just issued an expanded gag order.
Right.
Because last week the judge issued a gag order barring Trump from talking publicly about the witnesses, the court staff, and the jurors. And then this week the judge had to expand it, the gag order, to include his own family, the judge's family, and the district attorney's family after Trump started personally attacking the judge's daughter. You have a take on this? Because I've seen some of our conservative pals, even ones that are like not always the worst, suggest that the gag orders on Trump are, you know, like obliterating his First Amendment or something.
You and I can say anything we want about anybody because we're not the defendant. He is a criminal defendant. His trial is at issue here. The integrity of his trial is at issue here. And he does not have the same rights to speak as other people with respect to matters pertaining to the trial and the people participating in the trial. And he abuses, you know, his right of free speech by attacking people and trying to intimidate people. I mean, the danger is that witnesses will be intimidated, even if he doesn't attack the witnesses themselves. I mean, what or jurors? I mean, a juror or a witness will go into that courtroom and think, oh, he can say all this stuff about the judge's daughter. I mean, he's going to take after me if I find him guilty or if I testify. Wait till after the trial, he's going to go after me. And it can be very, you know, that has an intimidating effect, and it's intentional. Yeah. I mean, that's just what he does. So he does not have the right to do any of these things, and he's going to continue to push the envelope, and he lacks sufficient self-control to be able to comply with these orders, I think. And the question is, what do you do when he ultimately crosses the line, which actually he probably has
what
already.
What do they do?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, there are sanctions short of throwing him into the lockup in the tombs in Manhattan or Rikers or whatever. The judges has suggested that he might prevent Trump. I don't know whether he would include the lawyers in this, from learning the identities of the jury, which I think he ought. I mean, New York law may say differently, but if you remember in the E. Jean Carroll case, which was under, you know, federal procedural rules, the judge made the jury anonymous so that neither side, including Robbie Kaplan and her people and E. Jean Carroll, neither side knew the names of the jurors. They were all identified by numbers. And then the judge said for both jury trials, when he discharged the juries, he said, my advice to you is don't tell anybody you were on this jury. Mm. And we don't even know, to this day, we don't know who these jurors are. We know little bits and pieces about them, but we don't know their identities.
That seems like a good practice.
It is a good practice. It's a practice usually never seen in civil cases. It's seen in basically mob cases, RICO cases in federal court. And basically his behavior is, he's even worse than a mob boss. The mob bosses, you know, they don't try to attack or intimidate the cops or the judge. They kind of know not to do that because even though they're probably psychopaths, they're not completely insane. Donald Trump has no such inhibitions, which tells you a lot about Donald Trump. So, he behaves in many, many respects like a mob boss. He demands that kind of loyalty. He acts like he's not constrained by rules, and he isn't. So, you know, I mean, he ought to be constrained by rule, the very kinds of protections that the court system gets and imposes when a mob boss is tried, I think should apply to him.
All right. I want to turn quickly to the New York business case because Trump did manage to post that $170 million bond this week. Apparently, California billionaire Don Hanke footed the bill.
Hanke.
Like as in hanky panky.
Hanky panky.
Hanky said that the bond was a good business deal, and he's charging Trump a modest fee. Doubtful. Doubtful that it's a good business deal. From the Washington Post, Trump has gained stays in the two most daunting civil cases against him without having to forfeit any of his assets or sell any of his properties, nor did he have to touch stock he has in his social media company, Trump Media and Technology Corp Group. Stake that was still valued around $4 billion Tuesday afternoon despite the stock's price's recent slide. It looks like Trump dodged all those bullets
He did it. He did it, but I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing for the reasons I said last week. The purpose of the security requirement, the bond requirement, is to protect the interests of the judgment creditor, E. Jean Carroll in the case of the civil defamation and rape case, and then the state of New York in the AG case. And if he could not post the bond in either case, then the judgment would be unsecured. And there wouldn't be what's going to happen now is if E. Jean Carroll wins on appeal, which I'm pretty confident she will, the $83.3 million will be dispersed by Chubb's federal insurance subsidiary to her within a matter of days. Money is there. There is no question. She will get that money if she wins. Similarly, with respect to the $175 million bond that was issued by whatever Hanky Panky is, assuming he's good for it, I have no reason to believe he isn't good for it, the state's going to get that $175 million. Because Hanky Panky will be on the line for it, and he is committed to
and
that.
And so when he says a modest fee, so what, Trump pays him back with a little interest?
Usually there's an upfront fee. Like, okay. like you know, like when you take out a mortgage, there's an origination fee, And there is some kind of, I don't know the business model, and I don't know the economics of it, but
this guy made all his money, just by the way, providing high interest loans to people in dire economic circumstances who wanted to buy a car. That was his business model. Yeah. So he'd try them hard. I find that to be like a little bit funny. That's the person, and like he's basically taking a used car
financer.
Taking on a high risk client who doesn't pay his.
Trump. Well, who would buy a used car from Donald Trump? Many people say. Anyway, so the state is guaranteed the 175 unless hanky panky goes bankrupt or something, and that's good for the state, and it's good for the state in another way. It means that they don't have to send out lawyers to go out and chase down these assets, which would have been a nightmare.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have been difficult and a nightmare for Trump, which is what some people want to see. And a lot of people out there were disappointed that, Trump isn't being subject to asset seizures and forfeitures and whatever. But, that's a long and brutal process and would take a long time and it'd be expensive for both sides. And if I were in the state's attorney general, I'd be happy not to be engaged in that litigation, which is costly, time consuming and a pain.
The only thing that bothers me about this is that I would have liked to have seen, Trump says he has the money, and I would like to have seen him pay it and not one of these Republican donors get him off the hook.
If he had the money, I don't know. I mean, maybe he... I tend to credit that he couldn't get the $460 million dollar bond.
Sure.
I tend to credit that. But because I don't think he had that much in liquid
assets.
No, but
I think he had $175.
Yeah, and I think that's the reason why he was able to get the bond.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so it's sort of circular, but I don't know how the court, the appellate division, first department, which is the appellate court that cut the bond requirement down, came up with the 175. But it's $175 million that the state will not have to work for if it obtains an affirmance of the judgment. Of at least $175 million. I mean, it's possible the judgment gets cut. We will see.
Okay. So I also want to get into just very quickly that a California court recommended that John Eastman be disbarred. And while that decision is on appeal, Eastman cannot practice law in the state of California.
Right.
Who's hiring that guy anyway? But the opinion said that Eastman conspired with President Trump to obstruct a lawful function of government of the United States, specifically by conspiring to disrupt the electoral count on January 6th, 2021. This is amazing to me how a bunch of people who tried to overturn the election with Trump are facing actual accountability,
yes,
including the people who stormed the Capitol, yep, who were in jail, but not Trump.
Yeah, and we've seen these disciplinary proceedings or sanctions proceedings against lawyers proceed. I mean, we saw Jenna Ellis and Rudy, and now this is actually the most severe thus far. Rudy is going to lose his license, I think. Look, what's amazing about this is essentially a factual finding after a full trial that Eastman conspired with Donald Trump to commit crimes. I mean, during the January 6th hearings, the January 6th committee litigated some attorney-client privilege issues with Eastman and got a federal district judge in California to hold that the documents that Eastman had, even if they involved communications with Donald Trump, many of them were exempt from protection under the attorney-client privilege because they were in furtherance of a crime. I mean, here we have a full-fledged finding after a trial, and this is essentially the kind of evidence, the kind of case that that Jack Smith will have to put on here in the district when the case comes back to Judge Chutkan, which I think it will in the January 6th the election is truly an election interference case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you think Eastman loses his thing for...
Yeah, I mean, Eastman now has been, he has been found by the state bar trial court to have engaged in conduct that makes him unfit to practice law. And he can take that. He's suspended right now, and it becomes final if he does not appeal or if it is affirmed by the California Supreme Court. So what's going to happen is next is that he will file some kind of a petition for review in the Supreme Court of California, and I suspect the Supreme Court of California will at some point affirm, and he will never practice law in California again.
Does that mean he can't become the head of the DOJ? Because I just like think, when I think about Trump's cabinet, I always think Trump's going to take the people who tried to overturn the last election and like put them in charge of DOJ. Like,
well, that's an interesting question. It's not clear that you to be attorney general that you have to be a lawyer. There's no law that says that. There would be a, you know,
barely the attorney general doesn't have to be an attorney.
I don't think that there necessarily is a legal requirement that, the attorney general
you don't
be
think
an
it's
attorney.
Implied?
No, I don't okay. I don't think necessarily it is. I mean,
What do I know?
I mean, there's always been this question about whether or not somebody who's not admitted to the practice of law in a particular district court can appear on behalf of the government, but usually they just get themselves admitted. Trump's going to do whatever he wants to appoint people. I don't know that he's going to appoint Eastman, but he's going to appoint somebody nefarious to be attorney general. No question about it. He's not going to appoint any of these guys who, no matter...
Judge Cannon sounds like somebody who might be looking for a gig.
Oh, God help us.
Okay, I'm going to leave it there. Yep. I'm going to leave it there. George, as always, thank you for explaining the legal news to me. Thanks to everybody for listening. Don't forget to hit subscribe. Leave us a review on your podcast app. Email us at askgeorge@thebulwark.com. Get tickets for our live show on May 15th in Washington, D.C., and we will see you next week.
Thank you very much.
Well, George Conway, he's a man with a plan. Got to sit down with Sarah Longwell, take a stand. Explained all the legal problems they're piling high. With Donald Trump, oh my, oh my, oh my. He said, Sarah, let me break it down for you. There's obstruction of justice, corruption too. The legal tangles and troubles, they're growing fast. It's a storm that's gonna last and